He had a sense of falling, and there was his course laid out before him. It wasn't an honorable course, but it was the only one he had. It almost amounted to treachery. You will remember that it was Hazel's pleasant social custom to ask questions but not to listen to the answers. People expected that, depended on it. Suppose, he thought, I was to ask and then listen, but not let on I'm listening. It was sneaky, but the intention was clean, and the end infinitely to be desired. He would not only listen, he would remember, and he would put all the answers together. Maybe then he would be able to think her and do her. One question would be enough, he thought. Maybe two. Hazel was weary from his effort. He reclined, put his head on his arm, and slept the good sleep of work well done. Chapter 32. Hazel's Quest. Joe Elegant came cautiously back from his journey, ready to take another one at a moment's notice. He expected reprisals for Hazel's costume, and there were no reprisals. In gratitude, he made popovers at the Bear Flag 3 evenings in a row, and the girls didn't even know what they were eating. He wanted to know what had happened, but he was afraid to ask. Thus, Joe Elegant was glad when Hazel called on him in his little lean-to in the rear of the Bear Flag. "Sit here," he said. "I'll get you a piece of cake." While he was gone, Hazel regarded the works of Henri the Artist on the wall, one from the chicken feather period and one from the later nutshell time. And he looked at the card table on which Joe Elegant worked at a portable typewriter. There was a neat pile of manuscript on the table, green paper typed with a green ribbon. A sheet of paper was in the machine. It began, "My dear Anthony West, it was sweet of you." Joe came back with a wedge of cake and a glass of milk for Hazel, and while Hazel munched and drank, Joe's large, damp eyes bracketed him but never hit him.
"How'd it go?" he asked.
"What?"
"Why, your costume."
"Fine, fine. Everybody was real surprised."
"I'll bet they were.
Did Max say anything?"
"He said I'd done fine. He almost cried."
Joe Elegant smiled with quiet malice. Hazel asked vacuously, "Say, what would you think was the matter with Doc?" Joe crossed his legs professionally, and his fingers rippled through the green-typed green pages.
"It's the whole and the part is the whole," he said.
"Come again?"
"It's many things and one thing. Doc's libido is driving him one way, and his conscience is pulling him another. His myth is the sea, the wind, and the tide, and he relates to it by collecting animals. He carries his treasures to his laboratory. He wants to hide them, and perhaps to place the dragon Fafnir on guard."
Hazel nearly said, "He sells them," but that would have given him away as listening.
"I knew a dame named Fafnir," he said. "Bertha Fafnir, 3rd grade. Used to do pictures of turkeys on the blackboard Thanksgiving. Had starched underskirts. They rustled, kind of."
Joe Elegant scowled faintly at the interruption.
"Distill the myth, and you get the symbol," he went on. "The symbol is the paper he wants to write, but that in itself has impurities, needs distillation. Why? Because it is a substitute, that's why. His symbol is false. That's why he can't write his paper. Frustration. He has taken the wrong path, and so he brings in false solutions. 'I need a microscope,' he says. I need to go to La Jolla for the spring tides. He will not go to La Jolla. He will never write his paper.
Why not?
Wrong symbol. We must go back to the myth, the sea. The sea is his mother. His mother is dead, but she is living. He is carrying treasures from his mother's womb and trying to save them. Do you understand?
Sure, said Hazel listlessly.
He needs love. He needs understanding, said Joe Elegant.
Who don't? Hazel asked.
I feel that I could help him if he'd let me.
I kind of thought he took a shine to Susie, said Hazel.
Joe Elegant let a shadow of distaste tighten his mouth. That would only be a new false path, a new frustration.
Hazel observed, some people like one thing, some another.
Very original, said Joe Elegant.
It was only a few steps from Joe Elegant's lean-to through the kitchen to the ready room. In the ready room sat Becky with her feet up, reading her mail. Becky subscribed to Pen Pals and had a lively correspondence all over the world. The sheet of rice paper in her hands was from Japan. Dear Pen Pal, it began, your interest missive receipt. How gondola the Goldie State. Japan girl do hair kink likewise, but not using bleach. My friend Mitsi Mitsuki very west in minded. Would try if you mailing small little container hydrogen peroxide double pressure.
Hi, said Hazel. Becky laid down her letter. Ever been to Japan?
Nope.
Me neither. How's Mac?
Fine. Say, Becky, what would you say was the matter with Doc?
Love, said Becky. Doc's aching away. Or if he ain't, he ought to be. Nice fellow like that.
He sets like he been pole-axed.
That'll do it, poor fella. If it was me, why, I'd go to him and put my cool hand on his brow and I'd say, Doc. The door of Fauna's room opened.
I thought I heard voices. Hello, Hazel. Ain't none of the other girls around?
Becky's poorly.
I come to ask you something, said Hazel.
Well, come on in here. Sit down. Want a snort? Is it private? I'll shut the door.
Yes, said Hazel, and that covered all the questions.
The snort brightened his eye.
What would you say was wrong with Doc?
I wouldn't have said it a while ago, said Fauna, but when he put on that tie, and then the other night,
hell, he was drunk, said Hazel. A guy will say anything when he's drunk.
No, he will not, said Fauna.
You think it's Susie?
Yes, sir. And if she wasn't nuts, she could go to La Jolla with him and help him work. Why, hell, she'd be in.
He's trying to write his paper.
He's got himself all bollocksed up, said Fauna. I'll bet he ain't even thinking about his paper.
He ain't thinking about nothing.
That's what I mean. If he could stop not thinking about Susie, why, he could start thinking about his paper. That's my opinion, anyway.
You think if she went to La Jolla?
I do, but she won't go.
He wouldn't take her, said Hazel.
If everybody wasn't such damn fools, he wouldn't get asked, said Fauna. I don't know what we're coming to.
Have one more snort?
I can't, said Hazel. I gotta see a guy.
It was only a coincidence that Joseph and Mary Rivas was also reading a letter when Hazel entered the grocery. Joseph and Mary was reading and cursing at the same time, cursing in obscure Spanish. The letter was from James Petrillo, and it spoke in no uncertain terms. If the threat in the letter could be carried out, it looked as though what the U.S. government could not do in keeping wetbacks out, the musicians' union could. The patron was in a stew. Ordinarily, what he could not eliminate, he joined, but Petrillo did not give him that choice. Joseph and Mary's mind strayed toward assassination. Hazel said, "How are you?" "Lousy," said the patron. "Ain't nobody feeling too good," Hazel observed. "Doc's setting over there like he's punch drunk." "What do you think's the matter with him?" "Christ knows," said the patron. "I got troubles of my own." "Funny thing," he said. "You know, last night I was coming home from Monterey late, and there was a shadow up in the vacant lot. It moved into that bright spot the street light throws up by the boiler, and I swear to God it was Doc sneaking around up there."
"No," said Hazel.
"I say yes."
The patron looked over the vegetables and the piled canned goods, and his eyes dwelt on the cardboard Coca-Cola girl in a swing.
"Know something?" he said speculatively. "Before the party, I would have said she was just one more tramp. Then she belted loose and moved into the boiler. And then, well, it looks like Doc seen something there. Maybe Susie's got something I missed. I've been thinking I might just take a whack at her."
"You can't," said Hazel. "She's Doc's."
"Hell," said the patron. "Dames don't belong to nobody. I might just whistle under her window."
"She ain't got no windows," said Hazel.
The patron smiled. Petrillo's poison was going out of him.
"Yes, sir," he said. "Maybe I missed something."
"You stay away from her," said Hazel.
Joseph and Mary drooped his eyes, and an Indian looked out for a second. Then he smiled again.
"Have it your own way," he said lightly. "I hear she's got a job."
This was the Golden Poppy. Long, narrow, high-ceilinged, small octagonal tile on the floor, dark wood counter with small round stools, units at intervals on the counter, jukebox slot, paper napkin holder, salt, pepper, sugar, mustard, catsup. Rear door to the kitchen with window and service shelf. Cash register at the front, cigarette machine beside the door. Long mirror behind the counter fronted by coffee maker, griddle, toasters, covered cakes and pies, stacked breakfast foods, donuts, rack of canned soup and soup heater, fight cards, movie schedule, bus timetable. There was nothing to be done about the Golden Poppy. It was a dour and gloomy place dedicated to good coffee and sad, soggy food. It could not compete with the gay and phony little restaurants springing up in Monterey with their checked tablecloths, show card murals, low ceilings, and candles in cork floats. The Golden Poppy didn't try. There were many people who preferred it to the newcomers, customers who liked cold, damp donuts, stringy stews, and canned soup. These diners distrusted fishnets on the walls and jokes on the menu. To them, food was a necessary but solemn sacrament about which there should be no nonsense. The rush hours were 7 to 8:30, breakfast, 11:30 to 1:30, lunch, 6 to 8, dinner. In between these hours, there were the coffee customers, the sandwich and donut people. In the evening came two rush times, at 9:30, when the early movie let out, and at 11:30, when the second show broke.
At 12:30, the golden poppy curled its petals, except on Saturday nights when it stayed open until 2 for the early drunks. The coming of Susie to the golden poppy had a curious but reasonable effect on Ella. She had, over the years, maintained an iron interdict against weariness and pain. If she had allowed herself to realize how miserable she was, she would have cut her throat. Susie did more than help. She took over, joked with the salesman, whistled over the sandwich toaster, remembered that Mr. Garrigus liked cream of celery soup, and remembered his name, too. For a day or so, Ella had watched Susie and refused acidly when Susie suggested that she go home and lie down for a couple of hours. Then her interdict cracked, and the crack widened. Abysmal fatigue, aching legs, and abdominal pains crept through. Ella was an exhausted woman when she came at last to admit it. Going home to lie down for an hour was first a sin, and then a luxury, and finally a drug. Now, when Susie said after the 9:30 rush, "Go on home and get a good night's sleep," it seemed perfectly natural. Not only could Susie hold the fort, but her terse professional gaiety was drawing in new customers. At 11:15, Susie had the 4 Silexes filled with fresh coffee, the hamburgers between waxed paper in the icebox, the tomatoes sliced, and the sandwich bread in the counter below the griddle. At 11:30, the customers came in a rush from the second show. Susie grew 6 extra hands, club sandwiches, melted cheese sandwiches, cheeseburgers, and coffee, coffee, coffee. The cash register jangled, and the change appeared standing up between the tits of the rubber mat. "How about a date Saturday?"
"Sure, love to."
"Is it a date?"
"Can my husband come?"
"You married?"
"I won't be if I keep that date."
"You're a swell-looking kid.
You're kind of pretty yourself. Here's your change."
"Keep it."
"Thanks.
Cheeseburger coming up. Sorry, 86 on the tuna fish sandwiches." In the seconds between orders, 3 of her extra hands carried dishes into the soapy water, rinsed and dried them.
"Hey, Mr. Gelfain, you forgot your umbrella."
"So I did. Thank you."
That'd be another quarter tip, and the quarter went into a slotted can marked Joe. Every morning when Joe Blakey came in for his coffee, a little pile of silver was put before him and checked in the account book. It was amazing how it added up. At 12:05, Hazel came in and waited against the wall until a stool was vacant.
"Hi, Hazel. What'll it be?"
"Cup of coffee?"
"It's on the house, Hazel. How've you been?"
"Okay."
Gradually the customers thinned out, and then they were gone. Susie's flashing hands put the golden poppy to bed, scrubbed the grill, washed down the counter, wiped the necks of the catsup bottles. She looked up to see Hazel sweeping out.
"Say, what the hell are you doing?"
"I figured we're both going the same way. I'll walk with you."
"Why not?" said Susie. "You can carry my books."
"What?"
"Just a joke."
"Ha, ha," said Hazel, seriously. They walked down Alvarado Street, all closed up except where the bars splashed neon culture on the sidewalk. At the tip of the Presidio, they stopped and leaned their elbows on the iron railing and looked at the fishing boats in the black water of the bay. They crossed the tracks, went past the Army warehouse, and entered the upper end of Cannery Row. And at last Hazel said, "You're a swell dame."
"Come again?"
"Say, what you think's the matter with Doc?"
"How would I know?"
"You sore at him?"
"How'd you like to mind your own business?"
"It's all right.
said Hazel quickly. I ain't bright. Everybody knows that.
What's that got to do with keeping out of my hair?
Nobody pays no attention to me, said Hazel. He offered this as a recommendation. Doc says I don't listen. He likes that.
They walked on in silence for a while. Then Hazel said timidly, He done everything in the world for me. Once he went character witness for me, and I ain't got no character. Once I'd have lost a foot, but he opened her up and shook powder on her, and I still got her.
Susie didn't answer. Their footsteps were loud on the pavement and echoed back from the iron fronts of dead canneries.
Doc's in trouble, Hazel said.
Their footsteps filled the street.
Anybody in trouble, why, they go to Doc. Nobody goes to him now he's in trouble.
Step, step, step.
I gotta help him, said Hazel. But I ain't bright.
What the hell do you want me to do? Said Susie.
Well, couldn't you go over and set with him?
No.
If you was in trouble, he'd help you.
I ain't in trouble. How do you know he's in trouble?
I'm telling you. I thought you liked him.
I like him all right. If he was in real trouble, like if he was sick or bust his leg, I'd probably take him some soup.
Jeez! If he bust his leg, he couldn't go to the spring tides, said Hazel.
Well, he ain't busted his leg.
They passed wide Ida's. Hazel asked, You want a beer?
No, thanks. Then she said, Ain't you going up to the palace?
No, said Hazel. I gotta see a guy.
Susie said, Once, when I was a kid, I made an ashtray for my old man and old lady.
They like it?
They didn't need no ashtray.
Didn't they smoke?
Yes, said Susie. Good night. Hazel was approaching a state of collapse. In his whole life, he had never sustained a thought for more than 2 minutes. Now, his resources reeled under the strain of 4 hours of concentration. And it was not yet over. He had to make 2 more visits, and then he had to retire under the black cypress tree to sift his findings. So far, he could see no light anywhere. His mental pictures were like those children's kaleidoscopes that change color and design as they are turned. It seemed to Hazel that a slight zizzing sound came from his brain. It was a catty night. Big toms crept about, their heads and shoulders flattened to the ground, seeking other toms. Lady cats preened themselves in sweet innocence, unaware of what they hoped was likely to happen to them. On the rocks off Hopkins Marine Station, the sea lions barked with a houndish quaver. The silver canneries were silent under the streetlights, and from somewhere on the beach, Cacahuete Rivas' trumpet softly mourned the Memphis blues. Hazel had stopped for a moment in appreciation of the secret night. He looked up at the boiler where Susie had gone, and into the streak of streetlight, he saw a figure move. From the shape and posture, he thought it must be the patron. In a way, it was none of Hazel's business. He walked up the stairs and knocked on the door of Western Biological. Doc sat on his bed regarding a heap of collecting paraphernalia, nets, buckets and jars, formaldehyde and Epsom salts and menthol, rubber boots and rubber gloves, glass plates and string.
On his table stood a small new traveling aquarium with a tiny pump and motor run by two dry cells. Morosely he watched the mist of white air bubbles sift through the seawater.
"Come in," he said to Hazel. "I'm glad to see you."
"Just come to pass the time of day," said Hazel.
"Good, I'm glad. A man feels silly talking to himself, and at the same time it's private. You're the perfect answer, Hazel."
"Say, Doc, I just remembered. What's astrophysic?
You don't really want me to tell you, do you?"
"Not very much. I just wondered. I signed up for it."
Doc shuddered. "I don't think I want to hear about that," he said.
"I bring you a pint."
"That's friendly of you. Will you join me?"
"Sure," said Hazel. "You're really going to La Jolla, huh?"
"Well, I guess I have to. That's one of the things I've been trying to figure out. I've made such a stink about it."
"A lot of people think you won't go."
"Well, that's one of the reasons I have to."
"Don't you want to?"
"I don't know," said Doc softly. He got up from the bed and disengaged a wire from the dry cell. "No point in wasting juice," he said. "I've been tearing myself down like a Model T Ford in a backyard. Got the pieces all laid out. Still don't know why it won't run. Don't even know whether I can get it together again."
"I could help," said Hazel. "I know about Model T's."
"It might turn out you know about people, too," said Doc. Hazel looked shyly down at his feet. No one had ever accused him of knowing anything before. Doc chuckled.
"That's my good Hazel."
"Say, Doc, what do you think is the matter with you?" Hazel was appalled at his daring, but he had asked, and Doc seemed to find the question reasonable.
"God knows," he said. "Some kind of obscure self-justification, I guess. I wanted to make a contribution to learning. Maybe that was a substitution for fathering children. Right now, my contribution, even if it came off, seems kind of weak. I think maybe I've talked myself into something, and now maybe I have to do it."
Hazel groped among his bits and pieces. "Mac's sorry about what him and Fauna done. He's just sick."
"We shouldn't be," said Doc. "I'm the one who messed it up."
"You mean you would have took Susie on?"
"I guess so. I've thought about it ever since. For a couple of days there, I felt different and better than I ever have in my life. A kind of built-in pain was gone. I felt wide open."
"About Susie?"
"I guess so. I'm supposed to have this wild, free brain without conventional barriers. And what did I do? I balanced a nasty ledger. I weighed education, experience, background, even probable bloodlines. Some of the worst people I ever knew had the best of all those. Well, there it is. Saying it has made it even clearer. I guess I've thrown it away."
"Why don't you give it one more try, Doc?"
"How?"
"Why don't you take a candy bar or a bunch of carnations and knock on her door?"
"Right from the beginning, huh? Sounds kind of silly."
"Well, dames is all dames," said Hazel.
"You may have made a discovery.
Have you seen her?"
"Yeah. She got that boiler fixed up real pretty. She got a job down at the Golden Poppy."
"How is she?
What did she say?"
Hazel cast about again among his broken pieces. Her vehemence came back to him. "When she was a kid, she made an ashtray for her papa and mama." Hazel let it hang there because it sounded ridiculous.
"Well, what about it?"
"They didn't need no ashtray," said Hazel.
"She told you that?"
"Yep."
"Let's have a drink."
"I can't, Doc. I gotta see a guy."
"This late at night?"
"Yeah."
And then Hazel confessed.
"You've been good to me, Doc. I wouldn't do no bad thing to you."
"Of course you wouldn't."
"But I done it."
"What?"
"Remember you always said you liked me 'cause I didn't listen?"
"Sure I remember."
Hazel's eyes were shy and ashamed. "I listened," he said.
"That's all right."
"Doc?"
"Yes?"
"Joseph and Mary's hanging around the boiler." Hazel couldn't remember ever having been so tired. He had put his mind to unaccustomed tricks, and it was just as he had been afraid it would be. He had got nothing. He had started out hoping to find some kind of light to guide him. What he had got reminded him of Henri's painting in nutshells. He wanted to sleep a long time, perhaps never to awaken to a world in which he now felt himself a stranger. He had made a mess of it. He wondered if he would make as bad a mess in Washington. He walked wearily through the vacant lot and up the chicken walk to the palace flophouse. He wanted to slip into bed in the dark and hide his failure in sleep. Mac and the boys were waiting up for him.
"Where the hell you been?" said Mac. "We looked all over for you."
"Just walking around," said Hazel listlessly. Mac moved and groaned.
"Jesus! You hit me a crack," he said. "Damn near killed me."
"I shouldn't have did it," said Hazel. "You want I should rub it?"
"Hell no! What you been up to?"
"When you get making plans, the sky is falling on my tail," said Henny Penny. Whitey number two asked, "Who you been with?"
"Everybody, just walking around."
"Well, who?"
"Oh, Joe Elegant and Fauna and Susie and Doc."
"You seen Susie?" Mac demanded.
"Sure. Went down to the Poppy for a cup of coffee."
"Look who's buying coffee."
"Who was on the house," said Hazel.
"Well, what did she say?"
"She says in the third grade she made an ashtray."
"Oh, Jesus," said Mac. "Did she say anything about Doc?"
"Yeah, I guess so."
"You guess so?
Don't ask me if you're going to be mean to me. That'll just get me mean."
Mac shifted painfully to his other buttock. Hazel felt ringed with hostility.
"I guess I'll go outside," he said miserably.
"Wait! What'd she say about Doc?"
"Said she didn't want no part of him, except..." "I'm gonna go on out."
"Except what?"
"Except he got sick or bust a leg."
Mac shook his head. "Sometimes you get me thinking the way you do. God Almighty, I shouldn't have let you out alone."
"I didn't do no harm." "I bet you didn't do no good either. I bet right now you're trying to figure out germ warfare, how to get Doc sick."
"I'm tired," said Hazel. "I just want to go to bed."
"Who's stopping you?"
Hazel didn't even take off his clothes before he went to bed, but he didn't sleep either, at least not until the dawn crept out from Salinas. His brain was blistered, and his responsibility rode him with surcingle and spurs.
Chapter 33, The Distant Drum.
Doc sat for a long time after Hazel left him. His chest rustled with feeling and his throat was dry. His top mind looked at him, a scientist, a thinker trained, conditioned to method, to exactness. No single thing could be permitted in unless it could be measured, or tasted, or heard, or seen. The laws of science were Doc's laws, and he sought to obey them. To break these laws was not only a sin to him, but a danger, for a violation would let in anarchy. He was frightened and cold. His middle mind screamed with joy at his discomfiture. "I told you! All through the years I've told you you were fooling yourself. Let's see you get back to analysis. I dare you." And the low humming mind in his entrails was busy too, aching and yet singing that the ache was necessary and good. Middle mind had its way. Doc thought, "Let's look at this. Here is a man with work to do. The girl, what is she? Let's suppose every good thing should come of a relationship with her. It still would be no good. There is no possible way for this girl and me to be successful. No way under the sun. Not only is she illiterate, but she has a violent temper. She has all of the convictions of the uninformed. She's sure of things she has not investigated, not only sure for herself, but sure for everyone. In 2 months, she'll become a prude. Then where will freedom go? Your thinking will be like tennis against a bad player. Let's stop this nonsense. Forget it. You can't have it, and you don't want it." Middle mind hooted, "You can't not have it, too. Whatever happens, you've got her. Take a feel of your pulse. Listen to your pounding heart. Why? You just heard the iron door of the boiler clang, that's why. You haven't even thought what that means yet, but you've got a pain in your gut because of that clang and because it's 3:13 in the morning." Low mind said, "Nothing's bad. It's all part of one thing, the good and the bad. Do you know any man and woman, no matter how close, who don't have good and bad? Let me out, or by God I'll set my claws in you and I'll tear at you for all your life. Let me out, I say. Feel this. This red burning, that's rage. Will you let it out, or will it fester here until it makes you sick and crazy? Look at the time. You heard that iron door." Doc looked at his watch. 3:17. "Why, that son of a bitch," he said aloud. He snapped off his light and went to the window and looked out toward the strip of light the street lamp threw on the vacant lot. Then he opened his front door and crept down the stairs. Crossing the street, he followed a broad shadow and hid in it. The patron was sitting on a big rusty pipe trying to work out a puzzle. He had it laid out, and the pieces didn't make sense. Here was himself. Young, good-looking, snappy dresser, and making dough. And here was a dame, a dime a dozen dame, living in a boiler, working for her keep. The patron knew methods, too, and, if not scientific, they had served him well enough so that he could depend on them. You sweet talk, you promise, you offer, and in reserve,
You always hold force. Every dame needs a little force. He felt the swelling knuckles of his right hand. This dame was nuts. She didn't listen to his pitch. And when he brought up force, she slammed the iron door and damn near took his fingers off. He was going to lose the nails on all four fingers, the dirty bitch. Thus, musing bitterly, he did not hear Doc's approach. Doc's fingers locked in the collar of the patron's striped shirt and yanked him to his feet. By reflex, the patron lashed out with his foot and kicked Doc's legs from under him. The two fell together and rolled in the mallow weeds. Joseph and Mary tried for the groin with his knee, while Doc's delicate, strong fingers laced around the throat. The patron felt the thumbs seeking the hollow below his Adam's apple. He tore at the white face with his fingers, and Doc's thumbs went home. Flaring lights whirling in the patron's eyes, and his brain turned red. He knew that in 2 seconds his thorax would collapse under the thumbs, and he would be dead. He had seen it happen. He knew it, and, so knowing, he went limp, and in sweating terror felt the thumbs relax. The patron lay still, and his sickened mind figured the chances. The groin again, or butt of head to chin. But if he missed, the terrible thumbs would come again. He was weak and afraid. Afraid even to speak for fear the wrong word might draw the seeking thumbs. "Doc," he whispered, "I give up. You got me. Go near that girl again, and I'll tear your throat out," Doc whispered back. "I won't. I swear to God I won't." In the grocery under the 7-watt light, the patron tried to get the cork out of a pint with his smashed fingers, but had to pass the bottle to Doc. Doc felt the sickness that follows rage, and he also felt silly. He took a gulp of whiskey and passed the bottle over the counter. Joseph and Mary drank and then bent over, coughing and spluttering. Doc had to run around the counter to beat him on the back. When he could speak, Joseph and Mary looked at Doc with wonder. "I can't understand it," he said. "Where'd you learn that trick? What'd you want to do it for? You might have killed me." "I guess I wanted to," said Doc. "I must have wanted to." He laughed embarrassedly. "I thought you were making a pass at Susie."
"I was,"
said Joseph and Mary.
"Jesus, Doc, I didn't know you was that way with her."
"I'm not," said Doc. "Give me a drink."
"You wasn't playing tiddlywinks," said Joseph and Mary. "Now don't get excited. She give me the bum's rush. Hell, she damn near took off my fingers with that door. You ain't got any competition for me, Doc. She's all yours."
"She won't even see me," said Doc.
"Won't? What in hell is the matter with her?"
"Who knows?" They rested their elbows on the counter and faced each other.
"Beats me," said Joseph and Mary.
"What you going to do?" Doc smiled. "Hazel said take her flowers and a candy bar."
"He might have something there. I can't figure her."
Gingerly, the patron let a little whiskey dribble down his throat and winced as it passed the bruised place.
"I think she's just nuts," he said. "And if she's nuts, a guy's got to do nuts things. You don't think you could say the hell with her?"
"I have, over and over."
"Don't do no good?"
Not a bit. I know it's damn foolishness, but there it is.
I knew guys like that. There ain't nothing to do about it, I guess.
His eyes sharpened.
I remember something, he said. When I was talking to her through that damn fire door tonight, she says, "When I find a guy that's up to his eyes, I'll dive in," she says. And I says, "For Doc?" "Hell no," she says. "He's sliced like packaged bacon."
"I guess she's right," said Doc.
"That ain't what I was thinking. Look, Doc, when you had the hooks in me, if I'd went on, well, would you have?"
"I guess so. I can hardly believe it of myself, but I guess I would have. I never did anything like that before. Why?"
"Well, I just thought a guy that'd do a killing with his hands ain't sliced too thin. Let's finish the pint, Doc, and then I'll help you."
"Help me what?"
"Flowers," said Joseph and Mary. "We got an hour before daylight. Up above Lighthouse Avenue, there's front yards just lousy with flowers."
Chapter 34, The Deep Dish Set Down. Joe Elegant was only the cook at the Bear Flag, not the bouncer, with the result that his services were never required late at night. He retired early and set his alarm clock for 4. This gave him 3 or 4 hours every morning over his portable to tap out green letters on green paper. The book was going well. His hero had been born in a state of shock, and nothing subsequent had reassured him. When a symbol wasn't slapping him in the mouth, a myth was kicking his feet out from under him. It was a book of moods, of dank rooms with cryptic wallpaper, of pale odors, of decaying dreams. There wasn't a character in the whole of the Pie Root of Oedipus who wouldn't have made the observation ward. The hero had elderly aunts beside whom the Marquis de Sade was an altar boy. The pile of green manuscript was 3 inches thick, and Joe Elegant was beginning to plan his photograph for the back of the dust cover. Open collar, he thought, and a small, wry smile, and one hand relaxed in front of him with an open poison ring on the third finger. He knew which reviewers he could depend on and why. He typed, "A pool scummed with Azolla. In the open water in the middle of the pond, a dead fish floated belly up." Joe Elegant sighed, leaned back, and scratched his stomach. He yawned, went into the Bear Flag's kitchen, and started a pot of coffee. While it was heating, he walked out into a glorious morning. The pelicans were drumming in for a run of Tom Cod, and little pink Kleenex clouds hung over the bay. Joe saw the flowers in front of the boiler door and moved over to inspect them. A huge bouquet of tulips, early roses, jonquils, and iris. They might have been anyone's offering, except that their stems were in a museum jar. Joe Elegant's life had not been in danger since the engagement and raffle party, but he hadn't felt much friendliness in Cannery Row either. He carried his news into the Bear Flag and served it to Fauna on a tray along with her coffee and crullers. By 8 o'clock, the news was in the Palace Flophouse, and the early men were ingesting it with their whiskey sours at the La Ida. The best seats were in the ready room, with its windows overlooking the vacant lot. Mac was there behind a drape, munching Fauna's crullers. The girls were there in their best kimonos. Becky had put on her mules with the ostrich feathers. At 8:30, the audience heard the boiler door screech and shushed one another. Susie, on her hands and knees, poked her head out of the fire door and rammed her nose into the giant floral tribute. For a long moment she stared at the flowers, and then she reached out and dragged them inside. The iron door closed after her. At 9 o'clock, Susie reemerged and walked rapidly toward Monterey. At 9:30, she was back. She went into the boiler and in a moment came out, pushing her suitcase ahead of her. The audience was filled with dismay, but only for a moment. Susie climbed the steps and rang the bell at the bear flag. Fauna chased the girls to their rooms and Mac out the back way before she answered the door. Susie said, "You told me I could use your bathroom?"
"Help yourself," said Fauna.
In an hour, when the splashing had ceased, Fauna knocked on the bathroom door.
"Want a little toilet water, honey?"
"Thanks," said Susie. In a few minutes she emerged, scrubbed and shining.
"Like a cup of coffee?"
Fauna asked.
"Wish I could," said Susie. "I gotta run. Thanks for the bath. There ain't nothing like a good deep-dish set-down bath."
Fauna, from behind a drape, watched her crawl back into the boiler. In her office, Fauna scribbled a note and sent it by Joe Elegant to Western Biological. It read, "She ain't going to work today."
Chapter 35. Il n'y a pas de mouche sur la grand-mère. Doc laid his best clothes out on his cot. There were pale acid spots on the washed khaki trousers. The white shirt was yellow with age, and he noticed for the first time that his old tweed jacket was frayed through at both elbows. The tie he had worn to the dinner at Sonny Boy's was spotted. He found a black army tie in the bottom of his suitcase. For the first time in his life, he was dissatisfied with his clothing. It was silly to feel serious about it, but there was no doubt that he was serious. For a time he sat down and regarded his wardrobe and his life, and he found them both ridiculous. And not less ridiculous was the quaking certainty that he was frightened. He spoke aloud to the rattlesnakes, and they ran out their forked tongues to listen. "You are looking at a fool," he said. "I am a reasonable man, a comparatively intelligent man, IQ 182, University of Chicago, master's and PhD. An informed man in his own field, and not ignorant in some other fields. Regard this man," he said. "He is about to pay a formal call on a girl in a boiler. He has a half-pound box of chocolates for her. This man is scared stiff. Why? I'll tell you why. He is afraid this girl will not approve of him. He is terrified of her. He knows this is funny, but he cannot laugh at it." The eyes of the snakes looked dustily at him, or seemed to. Doc went on. "Let me put it this way. There is nothing I can do. They say of an amputee that he remembers his leg. Well, I remember this girl. I am not whole without her. I am not alive without her. When she was with me, I was more alive than I've ever been. And not only when she was pleasant either. Even when we were fighting, I was whole. At the time, I didn't realize how important it was. But I do now. I am not a dope. I know that if I should win her, I'll have many horrible times.
over and over. I'll wish I'd never seen her. But I also know that if I fail, I'll never be a whole man. I'll live a gray half-life, and I'll mourn for my lost girl every hour of the rest of my life. As thoughtful reptiles, you will wonder, why not wait? Look further. There are better fish in the sea. But you're not involved. Let me tell you that to me not only are there no better fish, there are no other fish in the sea at all. The sea is lonely without this fish. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
He took off his clothes and had a shower and scrubbed himself until his skin was soap-burned and red. He brushed his teeth until his gums bled. His hands were frayed with formalin, but he gouged at his discolored nails just the same, and he brushed at his overgrown hair, and he shaved so close that his face was on fire. At last he was ready, and still he looked for things to do, to put off his departure. His stomach was crowding up against his chest, forcing him to breathe shallowly. I should take a big slug of whiskey, he thought, but it would be on my breath, and she would know why I'd taken it. I wonder if she's frightened, too. You never know. Women can conceal these things better than men. Oh, God, what a fool I am. I can't go this way. I'm falling to pieces. My voice would tremble. Why, the little... No, don't do that. You can't build your courage by running her down. You're going to her, not she to you. Why do I say you when it's I? Am I afraid of I? And then he knew what to do. He went to his records. Then he found the art of the fugue. If I can't get courage from his greatness, he thought, I might as well give up. He sat unmoving while Bach built a world and peopled it and organized it and finally fought his world and was destroyed by it. And when the music stopped, as the man had stopped when death came to him, stopping in the middle of a phrase, Doc had his courage back. Bach fought savagely, he said. He was not defeated. If he had lived, he would have gone on fighting the impossible fight. Doc cried to no one, Give me a little time. I want to think. What did Bach have that I am hungry for to the point of starvation? Wasn't it gallantry? And isn't gallantry the great art of the soul? Is there any more noble quality in the human than gallantry? He stopped, and then suddenly he seemed to be racked with inner tears. Why didn't I know before? He asked. I, who admire it so, didn't even recognize it when I saw it. Old Bach had his talent and his family and his friends. Everyone has something. And what has Susie got? Absolutely nothing in the world but guts. She's taken on an atomic world with a slingshot, and by God, she's going to win. If she doesn't win, there's no point in living anymore. What do I mean, win? Doc asked himself. I know. If you're not defeated, you win. Then he stabbed himself in vengeance for having run Susie down. I know what I'm doing. In the face of my own defeat, I'm warming myself at her gallantry. Let me face this clearly, please. I need her to save myself.
I can only be whole with Susie.
He stood up, and he did not feel silly anymore. And his mission was not ridiculous. "So long," he said to the rattlesnakes. "Wish me luck."